Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Welcome to Africa Link, live from Bonn in Germany. I am Abubakar Jallo. These are our main stories. 34 African migrants found dead in Niger were trying to cross the Sahara Desert to reach Europe. The European Union has now come up with several strategies to deter people from attempting the journey. But will it work?
Migration is part of human nature, so it's not something you can stop. Stopping it would not happen.
Cameroon's parliament debates tougher laws on gays and lesbians.
The law is still very hostile to gay marriage and as a whole homosexuality in our penal code.
And why married women in rural parts of Ghana do not report their husbands to the police after suffering years of domestic violence? Stay tuned.
Top story.
We start with the unending tale of migration. On Thursday, authorities in Niger announced the discovery of 34 dead bodies in the desert near the Algerian border. 20 of them were children. Niger said all 34 corpses were sub-Saharan Africans who were trying to migrate to Europe across the Sahara Desert. They died of thirst and hunger and were abandoned by their smugglers. While much is known about the frequent deaths in the Mediterranean Sea, little is known about the hazardous journey across the Sahara Desert. DW's West Africa reporter Jan Philip Scholz has made the journey across the Sahara himself, and my colleague Jane Ayeke Kumet asked him for a description of his journey.
Yes, we actually spent some days in Agadez. Agadez is a small town really in the middle of the desert, and it's one of the main hubs for migrants on their way through the Sahara Desert to the Mediterranean Sea. This town actually lies on a very ancient trade route in the desert, but nowadays migrants account for a very large part of the business activities in Agadez. So we saw a lot of migrants there that stayed weeks or even months waiting for their chance to go through the desert, waiting for their chance for a trip further north. And of course, you can see a lot of human traffickers there. They try to sell them seats on pickup trucks or completely overloaded, very old trucks that leave the town and go into the desert, and nobody really knows if they will ever arrive in Europe.
What's the health situation like in terms of food and drinks?
Well, actually, of course, it is a very dangerous route. And what we know from this tragic incident that happened some days ago, the migrants probably died of thirst when they went through the desert. This is nothing unusual. Of course, we are talking about very remote areas in the desert with temperatures that can reach 40 degrees or even more. And there are also horrible sandstorms in the region. So those hostile conditions mean that actually only a very small fraction of those who die will ever be found.
What do we know about the people who use this route?
Most of them come from Western African countries. A lot of them actually come from either Niger Republic or from Nigeria. Some, of course, they leave their home countries because of conflict or because of war. But a lot of them also try to reach Europe because they don't have any perspectives in their home countries, which means, of course, first of all, they don't have any jobs. And sometimes they then become victims to human traffickers that promise them a great life in Europe, great jobs in Europe. And then when they actually reach, if they reach, because a lot of them actually die either in the desert or on the Mediterranean Sea, but when they reach Europe, a lot of them, they actually found out that it's all a big lie, and then they have to pay back huge amounts of money to the human traffickers.
Do you think that if people knew more about the dangers, would they be less inclined to make such hazardous journeys?
A lot of migrants actually are quite aware of the dangers, but for them, Europe seems so attractive that they are still willing to take the risk.
DW's West Africa reporter Jan-Philipp Scholz. The number of Africans trying to reach Europe is enormous. This prompted the European Union to engage in broad dialogue with countries on the African continent about migration and mobility. Jane Ayeku-Kumet has been speaking to Eugenio Ambrosi, who's the European Director for the International Organization for Migration, and she started by asking him if the EU strategy to work more closely with Africa was the right way to deter people from making the journey to Europe.
Migration is part of human nature, so it's not something you can stop. Stopping it would not happen, and therefore, if that's the objective, I don't think it would work. Again, one of the reasons why you wouldn't stop migration from Africa is also the fact that Europe, in any case, does need migrants for their own economy, for their own sustainability.
There is a commitment to fight irregular migration and address its root causes, as well as strengthen the management of borders and regular migration. The European Union aims to achieve this by 2017. Is this target date realistic?
It could be realistic if it's a comprehensive approach. The way to fight irregular migration is, I think, a multifaceted one. Border management is one aspect, but it's not the only one. Right now, what is fueling irregular migration is not simply the quality or the level of border management and border control that we have, but is also the fact that there are no sufficient ways of legally coming to Europe. Therefore, the objective can be reached by 2017 if the response is not only focusing on border management, but is also focusing on a variety of other policy area that needs to be accompanied.
But even then, why has it taken Europe so long to come up with concrete strategies to address the danger of illegal migration?
Part of the reason is the fact that migration has begun to receive a lot of attention in political terms in Europe since some of the latest events, starting from 2013 onward. So before that, there was less of a focus on migration because probably the phenomenon was not of such relevance or importance or level in Europe to require the top-level political attention.
Eugenio Ambrosi, the European Director for the International Organization for Migration. And this is DW's Africa Link with me, Abubakar Jallo.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
Cameroon's penal code is set to continue or perhaps intensify the criminalization of the country's lesbian, gay, bisexual and transsexual or LGBT communities. Sexual activity between members of the same sex in Cameroon is already penalized by 5 years in prison. Yet some lawmakers are calling for even tougher sanctions to be included in the penal code, which is up for review in parliament today. Moki Kinseka reports.
The Cameroon Association for the Defense of Homosexuality and Gay Rights Lawyers have been urging that members of LGBT communities should be protected from prosecution solely on the grounds of their sexual orientation as a basic human right. This is not likely to happen, according to lawmaker Honorable Joseph Banadzam.
The law is still very hostile to gay marriage and as a whole homosexuality in our penal code. Section 47.1 on homosexuality states that whoever has sexual relations with a person of the same sex shall be punished with imprisonment for 6 months to 5 years and a fine of 20,000 to 200,000. And there is no political party that is going contrary to the provisions of this section of the penal code.
Some lawmakers want even harsher provisions rather than more lenient ones. Nkom Alice, a 68-year-old gay rights activist, says the law, even as it stands at the moment, deserves condemnation. It promotes torture, forced confessions, denial of access to legal counsel, and encouraging the discrimination which gays have always been victims of in Cameroon.
Our constitution says that the state must protect all private life of everybody. We are not free in our country. We are not in a state of law. We are afraid because we are not backed by our state and the authorities in our state, which is not normal, which is against their own engagement of protecting everybody here. Their life is really, really in danger. Even if you complain, the authorities will do nothing just because you are gay or you are supposed to be defending gay people.
Although Parliament is examining the bill, observers in Cameroon are already predicting that nothing much will change, as traditionally, all bills deposited by the government are able to pass through assembly, which is dominated by the ruling party. Cameroon business lady Emmanuela Su appears to see no reason to amend the harsh legislation penalizing LGBT communities, which has been fiercely criticized in the West.
We should really guard our population. If we should open up to everything that comes from the West, we are, in other words, selling our culture, selling our originality, and selling what we are. Of course, they are human beings, but if they want to practice, let them do elsewhere. That's out of Cameroon, if Cameroon does not welcome it, because it goes against our beliefs, our traditions. Why is it only existing now?
Gay rights activists have died under suspicious circumstances on several occasions in Cameroon. At the United Nations, Cameroon was among a number of countries that blocked the accreditation of 22 gay and transgender groups at a UNAIDS conference meeting this month to spearhead efforts to end the HIV epidemic.
Moki Kinseka in Cameroon. And still to come, Namibia pushing Germany hard to accept it committed a genocide there in early 1900. Up next, rife domestic violence in rural Ghana.
Human rights.
Caught between modernity and tradition, women in northern Ghana would rather bite their thongs when their husbands assault them than report the matter to the police. If a woman defies this norm and reports her husband, her marriage automatically comes to an end. But because women want to protect their marriages, they choose to put up with the ordeal. This is why officers from the Domestic Violence and Victim Support Unit of Ghana's police now move from community to community to educate women about their rights. But in every community, almost all women rejected the police proposal. Only a few supported the call for action, making it hard to fight the scourge of domestic violence in Ghana. Maxwell Souk has been speaking to some of these women and now filed this report.
Alima Musa, a 33-year-old mother of two, shows the scars she got as a result of her husband's beatings. Normally, Alima should have reported her husband to the police, but she says she won't.
That concept is strange to us. It's not our norm. If you feel your husband abuses you, you go to your parents, but you don't let the police arrest him. We don't do that. It breaks up the relationship.
Another woman shares a similar plight.
We are suffering. Our husbands beat us and sometimes injure us. But after that, you just have to cry for some time and get well again, because we are afraid that if we report them to the police, the marriage will end then and there.
That's how things usually work here in northern Ghana. Women are ready to live with abuse, no matter what form it takes, rather than accuse their husbands of domestic violence. Officers from the Domestic Violence and Victim Support Unit of the Ghana Police Service arrived at Banvum, a small settlement, a 20-minute drive away from Tamale. This tour is to educate women about their rights. Imoro Yusuf is one of the unit's investigators.
The women want to protect their marriages. And because of that, their husbands have also capitalized on them, abusing them brutally. They beat them mercilessly. Just because they want to preserve their marriages, they don't report such cases to our office.
Ghana is among the countries with the highest incidence of gender-based violence, including physical, psychological, economic, and sexual abuse. This is because people still think that the husband is justified in beating his wife under certain circumstances, and no one can do anything against this.
We can't do what you want us to do. Should I report him and end my marriage just because he has beaten me? It's not part of our culture.
It's not a good idea. We can't support this call. Our chiefs and elders are there if there's a problem. They should settle it, not the police.
However, some women think the society is not fair to them on the matter of domestic abuse.
I support the call. If a man mistreats his wife, you can report him and they will discipline him, and next time he won't do it again.
The men can report their wives, but we, the wives, cannot report our husbands. Is it fair?
But men like Majid Zakaria, a farmer in Banvum, says that the day his wife reports on him, he will show her the door.
If my wife takes me to the police, it shows that she is more powerful than me, so I will let her go.
That is the predicament women face in northern Ghana. They are caught between modern human rights and tradition. Police records say less than a handful of women have come to report spousal abuses to their unit. It seems that this powerful tradition will continue to subject women to severe forms of domestic violence in years to come.
Maxwell Suk in Tamale, northern Ghana. There are calls in Germany for parliament to pass a motion acknowledging that German colonial era crimes committed in today's Namibia were genocide. Negotiations between both countries started early this year and are set to be concluded by the end of the present German parliament's term. Both sides were supposed to meet for a round of talks in Namibia's capital Windhoek this week, but the talks were postponed. DW's Daniel Pels has been speaking to Zed Ingaviru, Namibia's special envoy for the negotiations with Germany. He asked him if he would welcome a German parliamentary motion recognizing the killings of tens of thousands of Herero and Nama people in the early 1900s as genocide.
Oh, definitely. This is what we have expected. As you know, we feel this is a very good thing for Germany to do in order to for us all to start a new chapter in the relationship between Germany and Namibia.
Talks between Namibia and Germany's governments were supposed to continue this week in Windhoek, but according to our national broadcaster Deutschlandfunk, they did not. They were postponed. What happened?
No, that was just a change of the date in mutual consultation, you know, just to accommodate the stakeholders.
Germany's special commissioner for the talks, Ruprecht Polenz, said on Deutschlandfunk that currently Namibia needs time to sort out the involvement of a civil society in the talks. And does it mean that you want the civil society to play a more prominent role in the future in the talks?
I don't think civil society is the appropriate term to start with. We are talking of communities. And so far we have made arrangements for the participation of the victims and other affected communities. And they are participating at the level of a technical committee which was set up by the Office of the Vice President as chairperson of the Cabinet Committee on Genocide to participate in the formulation of the mandate that will be handed over to me in my turn to hand it over to my counterpart, in other words, to submit to the government of the Federal Republic of Germany. We have already made arrangements as far as that is concerned.
But there are some representatives from the victims' community or from the affected communities which are obviously very unhappy with the way negotiations are going, because they threatened that they would go to The Hague to get the chance to have direct negotiations with the German government. After these threats were made, don't you think there is any kind of need to rethink the involvement of at least some of these groups from the communities in the talks?
Talking about that, I think one has got to have clarity of what those that are not participating are actually expecting. One of these is what is referred to as the Ovairero traditional authority. And that's one authority out of seven authorities, six of which are participating. And the point that was made by the Ovairero traditional authority under the de facto leadership of Advocate Rukora, I say de facto, not de jure, this is what they initially said, that in fact their demand was the government should only facilitate, and it's up to anybody who is listening to consider whether you will have an agreement between a sovereign state and a community, which is under an independent sovereign state.
Zed Ngaviru, Namibia Special Envoy for Genocide Negotiations with Germany.
Your say.
And it's that time of the week when we turn the microphone over to you, the listener, to hear what you have to say about the stories we've been reporting. Crispin Mwakidu and Sela Oneko are here with this week's Your Say.
We shall dedicate this week's Your Say mostly to historical and present injustices facing African students and as well as people with albinism.
That's right, and South Africa on Thursday marked the 40th anniversary of the Soweto Uprising.
40 years ago, the South African apartheid regime shot and killed about 200 school children who were protesting against the enforcement of Afrikaans in schools.
And commenting on Facebook on DW News, Ryan Nortje said, "In commemoration, I implore everyone not to speak a word of Afrikaans on Thursday." But Ryan even takes it further and says that people should not speak Afrikaans at all.
But what is ironic, Sela, is that 20 years after South Africa ended apartheid and became a democratic state, inequalities in the education sector still persist.
Yes, and for an in-depth look at the Soweto Uprising and where things stand in the education system of South Africa today, visit our webpage, tw.com/Africa.
Now let's move to something different but more or less similar in terms of topic-wise. In Burundi, 5 secondary students remain in custody after they allegedly defaced photos of President Pierre Nkurunziza.
Yes, and Nkurunziza's portrait is printed in many Burundian textbooks, a matter which has led to quite some controversy.
And this story generated a long debate on social media forums, particularly from people in neighbouring Tanzania. Because of time, we will only read out a few.
So John Paul, while addressing Nkurunziza on Facebook, said, "Even students are now against you. And what do? You lock them up. One day, those who are supporting you will get fed up and remove you from power. Then Burundi will be free."
Fikiri Dario, however, says thorough investigations should be made on those students and then the law should take its course.
And last but not least, Wilson Mongi had this to say. "Placing charges on the students who defaced Nkurunziza's photo is right. But, President Nkurunziza, you should be aware by now that your citizens are unhappy with you because you violated the constitution of Burundi by remaining in power."
Turning to another story, the world marked the Albinism Awareness Day on June 13th. It's an important day bearing in mind that people with albinism face threats of injury or even death because some in African countries believe their body parts can bring wealth or good luck.
And commenting on this story, Otabek Abdurabanov said, "The greatest disease of them all is ignorance. Education heals prejudice."
Jeff Matska was too shocked by what he read and could only say, "Humans, we are a pretty strange species." And strangely enough, that's how we end this week's Your Say.
Crispin Mwakidu and Sela Oneko, thank you. And if you'd also like to have your comments read here on Africa Link as well, then send us an email to feedback.africa@dw.com or a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110 Bonn, Germany, or an SMS to country code 491609575950. And now, a reminder of the main stories we've had here for in the last 25 minutes. 34 African migrants found dead in Niger while trying to cross the Sahara Desert to reach Europe. In Cameroon, Parliament is debating tough laws against LGBT communities today. That's all we had time for. And as always, thank you for listening. Crispin Mwakidiu will be here with you on Monday. And do join him if you can. From me, Abubakar Jallo in Bonn, Germany, I wish you a pleasant weekend.